Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Interpol says that so-called security moms who have voted Republican since 9/11 are switching focus toward economic and education issues and are leaning toward Democrats. The same poll says only 2% of voters consider terrorism their top political priority. Joining us to discuss the numbers and other happenings in Washington this week is John Harwood. He's chief Washington correspondent for CNBC, and he also writes the Washington Wire column for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back, John.
Hey, great to be here.
Well, security, terrorism, that's been in the news quite a bit this week. Yet the polls show that people aren't as concerned with those issues as we may have first believed. Can you explain what the numbers are saying?
Well, we had a fascinating result from a Pew Research Center poll this week that asked what issues Americans most wanted politicians to talk about. And the things that ranked high were issues like gas prices and education, and one of the lowest was terrorism at 2%. That suggests that the administration is going to have a somewhat more difficult time than they expect to take advantage of positive news on the terror front and exploit the Democratic divisions in Connecticut, where Joe Lieberman was knocked off by Ned Lamont.
Mm-hmm. So we're back to it's the economy, stupid, sort of.
Well, the economy is a big issue. I'm talking to you now from Camp David, where President Bush has been meeting with his economic advisors. They're trying to look at gaps in their record, things they can do better over the last 2 years, and also convince the American people that the economy is actually strong. Right now, the Bush administration is much more impressed with its record than ordinary voters are.
We're going to be talking about the president's meetings about the economy coming up in the program. But, John, can you tell us how are Democrats trying to capitalize on this?
Democrats are doing a few things. People are out campaigning and trying to frame their records. Democrats noted the recent increase in emphasis on security by the Republicans. They are starting an effort next week to try to call attention to what they argue is waste, fraud, and abuse, $100 billion worth on Iraq, on Homeland Security, and on spending. That's part of their message offensive as we get close to the 9/11 anniversary.
A blow for the Bush administration this week, too, was the federal court ruling against the domestic wireless surveillance program. How do you think that's going to affect things for the president?
It is a blow both substantively and politically. Now, the administration is seeking a stay pending its appeal. They think they'll win in the end as this moves up through the judicial system, and they may be right. The political problem, though, is this decision tends to validate the critics who have argued that this program goes too far. Now, that doesn't mean this issue isn't one in which President Bush is on the strong side of public opinion, but anything that makes it more difficult for the administration to recover in the polls, and this is one of those events, is problematic in a midterm election where they're trying to hold the Congress.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Connecticut race with Joseph Lieberman and Ned Lamont, and there still seems to be a lot of uncertainties in that race. Latest polls showing Mr. Lieberman ahead by 12 percentage points, but then some big names like John Edwards and other folks getting behind Ned Lamont. How is this going to affect things in Washington?
Isn't it interesting the way both parties are playing this race? You've got the Democrats who want to run for president in 2008, like John Edwards, trying to appeal to the more liberal elements of the Democratic base. That's who supported Ned Lamont. They're out for him. You've got the Bush administration, the White House, not endorsing a Republican nominee. It's hard to remember when a mainstream Republican nominee has not been embraced by the White House, but they like the idea of Joe Lieberman doing well in this race and exposing splits between the left wing and the moderate wing of the Democratic Party. They think that lets them tell the American people, Democrats are weak and divided. You can trust us to keep you safe.
Hmm. I also read an article this week that said that there are lobbying firms that are now looking to hire Democrats because they're expecting that there's going to be a shift in Washington. Are you sensing that there is a shift, or is it too early to try to make these kinds of predictions?
Well, everybody's sensing that a shift is possible, maybe even likely, in terms of the House of Representatives. Democrats need to pick up 15 seats. That's many fewer than the historic average in elections of this kind as a two-term president is getting ready to leave office. It's not a slam dunk. We don't know that that's going to happen for sure. And the Senate is more problematic. They need 6 seats. That means they're going to really have to shoot the gap and get all the marginal seats and maybe pick up a couple that aren't so marginal. That could give Democrats control. But everybody agrees, including Republicans, that it's quite possible in this environment.
John, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
John Harwood is chief Washington correspondent for CNBC. He also writes the Washington Wire column for the Wall Street Journal. Almost a year after Hurricane Katrina ravaged the Gulf Coast, FEMA Director David Paulison addressed reporters today about the agency's preparedness for the next disaster. Paulison has said that FEMA has taken steps to correct its biggest problems and the right resources are in place to respond to the next disaster. But critics say lessons have not been learned and the agency is not prepared for this year's hurricane season, which is already underway. In a moment, what FEMA might learn about reconstruction from southern Lebanon. But first, joining us on the line from Washington is reporter Anna Radilat, who writes for the Gannett News Service. She recently interviewed FEMA Director Paulison. Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Can you remind us again, who is Mr. Paulison and what he is planning to do with FEMA now?
Mr. Paulison has headed FEMA almost for a year now, since former FEMA Director Mike Brown resigned under duress for because he was criticized harshly for the way FEMA responded to Katrina.
Mm-hmm. And when you talked with him, what struck you about him? Is he the man to take over this position after all of this?
He's a very no-nonsense guy, and I think he's trying to do his best in reforming the agency. But the agency has a lot of problems, and the debate in Washington is whether it can be reformed the way it is, because it's now under the authority of the Department of Homeland Security. Before, it was independent, and that gave it more autonomy and direct access to the White House. People say that since it's been moved into Homeland Security, which some people say was more focused on terrorism than natural disasters, FEMA was weakened.
Right. So then do we see now, aside from that sort of structural change, are we seeing something that is showing us that there's a new model here for FEMA? And what would that new model be?
Well, first of all, it's the sensitivity they have. They really are worried about another failure, another perceived failure. So they've done, I think, certain things within that they could do, and that's to respond to the next hurricane, to try not to duplicate some of the snafus that happened last time.
So what are the big things that are going to be repaired or have already been repaired as we look ahead to this current hurricane season?
Well, I think Paulison is proud of the fact that he's made a decision to locate a lot of emergency aid along the Gulf Coast. So they're pre-positioning a lot more stuff in case another hurricane hits. He's also trying to coordinate better with local responders by having a central command. Next time there's a hurricane or any kind of natural disaster, FEMA will move in and supposedly have a central command that with local and state responders. During Katrina, one big problem was no communication between FEMA and some local responders.
Mm. Now, I also understand that there's been some criticism about continuing to coordinate the response with state and local officials and determining who's going to be in charge of what in the event of an emergency. Is this still a problem, would you say, Anna?
I think, there are some differences of opinion, but I think even Louisiana realizes that Louisiana and other states are trying to coordinate better with FEMA beforehand.
Mm-hmm. So what are the big concerns right now, would you say, and what are the main obstacles?
Well, FEMA has lost a lot of senior personnel. A lot of people retired. And it's unclear whether Paulison has been able to hire enough people to make up that loss. There's also other problems. The Congress has not been able to pass a bill that would allow greater changes at FEMA.
Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that Mr. Paulison talked about changing the whole culture of FEMA. What does that mean exactly?
I think, he's used the term, he's admitted that FEMA was arrogant, that the victim had to jump through several hoops to get it help. It was the bureaucracy, the red tape. And I think he's trying to drive a message home to that agency that, no, we got to cut through some of this.
There were some problems, I think, that Mr. Paulison had to address about the no-bid contracts that went out right after Hurricane Katrina. How much of an issue has that been for him?
I think it's, you know, well, not much of an issue because what he's done as part of trying to make FEMA more responsive is do preposition some of the contracts, have agreements with some contractors before a disaster hits so they can mobilize very quickly afterwards. Mm-hmm. And he's made these agreements with some of the big contractors that got no bid contracts to to respond to Katrina.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Anna, thanks very much for speaking with us.
All right. Thank you.
Anna Rodelot is a Washington-based correspondent for the Gannett News Service. Despite the changes at FEMA, there are reports of debris still in the streets of New Orleans and families still in temporary housing with no clear plan in place for the city's future. But a world away in the Middle East, the relief effort there appears to be an example of effective reconstruction. Newspaper reports from southern Lebanon suggest that volunteers for the militant group Hezbollah are fanning out across the country, offering rent money, clearing rubble, and promising to find homes for victims within 72 hours. We turn now to an expert on logistics to talk about what works when disaster, man-made or natural, strikes. Yossi Sheffi is a professor of engineering systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and he's author of the book The Resilient Enterprise, Overcoming Vulnerability for Competitive Advantage. Welcome to the studio, Professor.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Well, we just heard from Anna about some of the things that's happening for FEMA and the level to try to improve its response to disaster. She says FEMA was arrogant and there was a huge bureaucracy there. What would you say about that? Were those the main problems that you would see?
These are certainly some of the problems. There were also one of dozens of agencies and organizations that are trying to take control of the situations. There was also lack of communications. But these are some of the issues that are being addressed. One of the issues that FEMA is trying to address, it's a much longer-term issue, is the arrogance and bureaucracy. These are cultural issues that are very difficult to change quickly.
MIT professor Yossi Sheffi, he's an expert on logistics. He'll be back with us in a moment to talk about how organizations with deep ties to a community can be more effective than government bureaucracies in delivering aid. Also, we ask, is the militant group Hezbollah offering a model for reconstruction as it works on rebuilding Lebanon? And we know that this is a provocative question, and we'd love to hear your thoughts. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or give us a call and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Model for reconstruction in the news this week. What the militant group Hezbollah is doing to rebuild southern Lebanon after a month of fighting. Professor Sheffi, I want to ask you about a promise that Hezbollah has made to find homes for people in need within 72 hours. What does that tell us about what's happening with the relief effort over there?
Well, first of all, it tells us that they're very good at making promises and having the media pick up the promises. Let's visit it in a year and see what has actually been delivered. One of the main differences, of course, is that we will probably not visit it in a year, and we will not, and the media will not check out on what was delivered. And if something was promised and not delivered, there was no legal system to then follow up on this. This said, however, and I'm, of course, not drawing any comparison between a terrorist organization and any government, let alone the United States government. But it is clear that some elements of quick response shown by Hezbollah are impressive in the sense that there are certain principles of quick response and being resilient and bouncing back from a disruption that are being demonstrated in the field in southern Lebanon. For example, two of the most important ones are distributed decision-making, in the sense that the people on the ground make the decision. There is no big bureaucracy to check with. They don't have to. If they promise $10,000, they just promise it. Nobody will come back to check if they delivered or did not deliver. They have the authority to say it.
No government. There's no government role.
There's no government role. But even beyond this, there's no even organization and accountability, which in this case, because of the second element of the operation, and this is the passion and voluntarism. And this is a big difference between what happened after Katerina and what is happening in southern Lebanon. A lot of these people, some Hezbollah, some are not, are volunteers that are trying to help their countrymen. There was a huge outpouring of voluntarism, not only in terms of incredible amount of money that were contributed to the Katerina victims, but also people were trying to physically help. And whether it's FEMA, Louisiana, New Orleans, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Coast Guard, whatever, we are not in a situation when we can very effectively, we know how effectively utilize volunteers. Mm. There were thousands of volunteers, companies, individuals, and we are not. We did not yet develop a good framework to harness all the goodwill that comes after every disaster in the United States. Mm. This is something that does not seem like the FEMA or the various congressional investigations are looking at, but it's certainly something that it's a force that is just being wasted, if not harnessed.
So volunteers, what else do you think that the United States might look at in the Hezbollah reconstruction efforts and sort of say, well, this is one model of how relief might work. What might work for us?
Look, again, it's in many ways, the comparison is not fair, quote unquote. The main problem during Katerina was that the disaster was not recognized until it was too late. It was not recognized even though there are 3-4 days forecasters were going on the radio and television telling everybody it's going to be the worst that they ever seen. Even while it was going the first few days, the White House and FEMA did not realize how bad it is. That's one problem that Hezbollah did not have. They caused the damage. So there was no issue of finding out is there a damage or not. Also, with all the talk about the destruction in southern Lebanon, the destruction of an urban area is significantly more difficult to deal with. Then we have all, as I mentioned before, the legal frameworks, the coordination problems, all the various bodies that are involved in it. Many of the issues FEMA is trying to address. They're certainly addressing the coordination issue by coming up with a central command. By prepositioning local aid, they are doing the right thing. We are a much bigger country. There's no issue of prepositioning in Lebanon. I mean, the whole country is, you drive in 3 hours from one side to the other. So in a country the size of the United States, of course, they're doing the right thing, but starting to prepositioning in order to get fast response. So FEMA is doing many of the right thing. I'm less worried about doing the technical thing right, prepositioning it right, creating the communication frequencies, the communication protocol. I think one of the things that is clearly hardest and the most important is changing the culture of the organization, changing the culture to act first, look at the customer, the victim first, regardless of what's the organization charged, who is responsible
right,
for what.
I'm wondering if it's possible to eliminate sort of the chain of command and all those layers.
It is certainly possible. Even during Katerina, we all forget that some organization worked very well. The Coast Guard, for example, has saved during the first few days of Katerina about 26,000 people compared to 4,000 that it usually saves in a year. So if you look at the Coast Guard website, it's interesting that if you look at the credo of the Coast Guard right after patriotism and integrity, you have local initiative. It's one of the guiding principles of the Coast Guard. And in this case, it worked unbelievably well. Local commanders, local ship captains moved the equipment and started plucking people out of the water, having no command. They're part of the Department of Homeland Security. They did not have any directive from the Department of Homeland Security to start it, but they just did it.
I'm wondering just briefly, can you tell me, do you think that based on what you've heard that it appears that FEMA has made significant changes?
It seems that they're doing significant changes, but I think it's a long-term problem. They probably are doing as well as they can be doing with the current framework, with the current legal framework, with the current organizations that we have. The problem that we have is much longer term.
Yossi Sheffi is a professor of engineering systems at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of the book, The Resilient Enterprise, Overcoming Vulnerability for Competitive Advantage. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering. Promoting engineering and technological
have recognized a link between extreme poverty and poor health. A study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine says middle-class Americans are also more likely to suffer from a health-related disability than their wealthier counterparts. The lead author is Dr. Meredith Winkler, a professor of health and public behavior at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. And Dr. Minkler, can you tell us first how you defined health-related disability for this study?
We are looking at functional limitations, which are things like difficulty walking upstairs, walking a few blocks, lifting things. We also looked at more extreme forms of disability, requiring a wheelchair, for example. But even with the more common functional limitations, we found a real difference depending on people's income.
Mm-hmm. And how did you define income?
We actually looked at poverty line as being, back in 2000, about $8,000 a year. People at 600% of poverty line are those making about $50,000 a year, 700%, $60,000 a year. So these are not the multimillionaires we're talking about. But in this society, if you're a single person over 65, and you're making $50,000 a year, that's considered a good upper-middle-class income.
Where did the data mostly come from for this?
They all came from the census, which conducts a special survey now, the American Community Survey. They take a 0.6% sample of the entire U.S. population, and it's representative, and it's oversampled for groups that are hard to reach. So it's a very high-quality data set.
What exactly were you looking for?
Well, we were interested in a couple of things. Number one, disability is not studied as much as premature death and illness rates from various causes. And yet, when you think about it, disability is the final common pathway for many chronic illnesses. This is how they end up affecting our health and our quality of life. So it seemed important to look at. We also know that most studies have focused on extreme poverty and the relationship with health outcomes like disability, and haven't really looked at the upper end of the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what did you find exactly in terms of a difference with middle-class income folks and others who may have more money?
Well, the big difference, of course, is still between those in poverty and those with more money. The people 55 to 64, for example, who were living in poverty were six times more likely to have disability than those who are living at 700 times the poverty level. But even if you look at the difference between people making $50,000 a year and those making $60,000 a year, and these are people 55 and above, we found substantially higher rates of disability.
Hmm. So did that surprise you?
Yes, it did. We didn't expect to see things that dramatic at the upper ends of the spectrum that we looked at.
Are there any possible theories about why that might be? I know one of your co-authors said that people with less money tend to have less access to medical care, but he also said there may be something going on in life for those who are at lower income levels, and something that's not easy to maybe understand or articulate.
Right. There's a lot of things that can be going on. We know that the upper class, for example, has lower smoking rates. They have less stress, by and large, better access to health coverage, better environments in which to live. If your environment is just a little better, more accessible in terms of walking around. You're not going to be as limited if you begin to develop a limp or difficulty walking. A neighborhood that's more accommodating is going to make it easier for you to continue to lead a more active and healthy lifestyle. The other issue that's important to mention is that while people 65 and over tend to have Medicare coverage, Medicare misses a lot and requires, as you know, a 20% deductible for most preventive services, even the ones that they do cover. If you're living on $50,000 a year, you're maybe helping put a child through college, you're less likely to be able to easily decide that you're going to pay for those extras, and as a result, you may suffer the consequences.
So what does it say, though, about someone's control over their health outcome? I mean, does it say maybe or suggest that people in lower income brackets may not be able to influence the outcome of their health as much as those in higher income brackets?
Absolutely. The higher you go up the spectrum, the more likely you are to be able to impact on the conditions in which our health plays out. And this is a very important pathway by which people with more money tend to do better later in life, whether it's disability or the presence of chronic conditions or other kinds of things.
Did this study at all leave some unanswered questions for you? There are still things that you think need to be looked at further?
Oh, absolutely. We know that that social class tends to be the main reason that people who are in different racial ethnic groups, such as African American, Native American, Hispanic, have worse health outcomes. But we know that more is going on, and particularly with African Americans, you can control for social class and you can still see worse health outcomes. We know racism is a factor in impacting on health. So we need to, while emphasizing the importance of social class, never lose sight of the role of those other factors, and particularly things like race, racism, and ethnicity, as these impact on health.
Where would you like to see your study go from here? Where would you like to see the results applied?
Well, I would love to see policymakers in this country get serious about the fact that income is probably the single most important determinant of our health. Smoking is up there, many things are up there, but nothing or almost nothing is as important as how much money people have on which to live, the circumstances in which they're able to live by virtue of their social class. And that means that rather than just focusing on health care access and health insurance, we define health policy broadly. We look at things like taxation policy and how our budget cuts, for example, that overwhelmingly help the wealthy, going to impact ultimately on health outcomes for people with less income.
Dr. Meredith Minkler is professor of health and public behavior at the School of Public Health at the University of California at Berkeley. She's the lead author of a study that looks at the connection between health-related disabilities and income levels of middle-class Americans. Coming up, jazzman Terrence Blanchard provides words and music for Spike Lee's blistering new documentary about Hurricane Katrina. You're listening to Here and Now. As we said earlier in our program, the economy appears to be a main issue for American voters with the congressional midterm elections looming. President Bush had his yearly meeting with his economic team at Camp David today. Speaking to reporters afterward, the president said the future is bright.
All of us here are confident about the future of this country. Over the past 5 years, our economy has faced unprecedented challenges, from recession to corporate scandal to terrorist attack to natural disasters. And through it all, Our free enterprise system has proved to be the most resilient and responsive in the world.
That's President Bush speaking at Camp David today. However, a recent Associated Press poll says that Americans are not as optimistic as the president. Only 37% of Americans support President Bush's handling of the economy. Well, we turn now to Mark Zandi. He's chief economist of MoodysEconomy.com. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the president said today the economy is performing in line with expectations. Tax cuts are driving things forward. What are your thoughts?
The economy is performing reasonably well. This is the fifth year of economic expansion. The unemployment rate has declined. It's now 4.8%, which is consistent with full employment. So it's a good performance, but I don't think it has anything to do with tax cuts. I think it has everything to do with the ingenuity and hard work of American businesses and households.
What about the concerns that have been expressed recently about inflation and the Federal Reserve holding interest rates? How much of a worry is that?
It is a concern, and it's clear that the economy's performance is weakening. It had done very well in 2004, 2005, and now in 2006 things are eroding a bit. Inflation has picked up as well as interest rates, and the economy is going to slow as it makes its way through the remainder of the year into next.
Hmm. And how about housing? There's been some bleak news about housing. This week it was reported that sales of existing homes declined in more than two dozen states. New home construction was down 2.5% last month. How is that affecting the overall economic picture?
Well, housing is the principal casualty of higher interest rates. As rates have moved up, it's made it, housing much less affordable, particularly in the context of the surge in house prices that occurred up and through the end of last year. So housing is taking the brunt of all of this, and it's going to weaken further. We're going to see further declines in sales and new construction and in house prices, and that's the key reason why growth will slow as we make our way through the year.
So the booming housing market's over.
It's over. It peaked a year ago, and we've got at least another year, perhaps two, before this all plays out.
What about jobs? The president today talked about the country adding 5.5 million new jobs since August of 2003, but there was also some bad news today. Ford Motor Company says it's going to cut North American production by 21%. How do you see the employment picture here in the U.S.?
The job market's been okay as well. We've created a lot of jobs in the last few years, and that's how we got to a 4.8% unemployment rate, which, as I said earlier, is full employment. Most people who want a job are working. The job market is weakening, however, as the housing market cools. We're seeing much fewer jobs created in housing-related industries, and that's going to continue. And it's perhaps most important to point out that the good economy job market has been good for very high-income, educated, skilled workers. For lower-skilled, less-educated, lower-income workers, it's been much less good. And one of the reasons why is because of layoffs in manufacturing, particularly in the auto industry, and Ford is an example of that today.
Mm-hmm. And what about gas prices? How is that affecting things?
Well, gas is also higher. Obviously, almost record-high gasoline prices have been an irritant. And again, particularly for households that are in the lower part of the income distribution, To just give you a statistic, those folks that are in the bottom 20% of the income distribution devote over 10% of their budget on energy. So when gasoline prices rise, that's a problem.
Hmm. So as we said, midterm elections are coming up. We have both parties here trying to make political capital out of the economy. The vice president has said the economy is kicking along. The Democrats say that's not the case. You think anybody's going to have an edge here? And how would you describe the economic picture?
The economy is okay, but it's a weakening, and as we make our way to the election in November, I think it's going to weaken further. So, you know, the Democrats probably are going to gain a little bit of leverage here as we make our way to the election. At Election Day, early November, unemployment will probably be higher than it is today.
All right. Well, Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Zandi is chief economist for MoodysEconomy.com. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Backed up the lake, my understanding is the lake backed up a Category 1 into our levees, and they failed.
And it cost the people. It cost the people their homes and their lives. I hope the politicians, whoever they did this, the Corps of Engineers, whoever's responsible, I hope that they can sleep at night.
You know, somebody needs to go to jail. Somebody needs to go to jail because those levees were never really maintained the way they should have been. And now it's too late.
Those are just a few of the more than 100 New Orleans residents interviewed in the new Spike Lee film, When the Levees Broke, A Requiem in Four Acts. It's a documentary about Hurricane Katrina and its aftermath. The four-hour film premieres on HBO next week. Requiem has been called candid and graphic. Director Spike Lee said making the film for him was an obligation.
When Denzel Washington and I were doing Malcolm X, everywhere we went, people would say, don't mess it up. We're glad you're doing it. And when we came down here in New Orleans, it was the same. And it just wasn't African Americans. It was people who lived here were saying, Spike, we're glad you're here. Tell the story.
Thousands of Crescent City residents got an advance viewing at the New Orleans Arena this week. The film was emotional for many who wiped away tears or booed loudly when President Bush and other government officials appeared on screen.
There are people on there that was telling it like it is. No other way to tell it than the truth. Tell it to the people. Let them get the message if they already didn't get the message.
I think that it kind of captured the anger, the hurt, the despair, the hopelessness. And at the same time, you know, I think that the movie kind of wrapped back around and distributed a lot of the blame where it needed to go.
If you compare it to, say, Fahrenheit 9/11, of an indictment of government irresponsibility, government non-accountability, I think it's more powerful.
Well, there had times that I wanted to cry, but I couldn't.
Musician and composer Terrence Blanchard has written film scores for 13 Spike Lee films, including this one. This time, he steps in front of the camera, too. Robin Young reached Terrence in London during his band's European tour.
Well, one of the most wrenching scenes in When the Levees Broke is when you return to your childhood home with your moms. Let's listen.
Oh, look. This thing is way over here.
What is that?
That's the thing you gave me. It was over here. What is that over there?
That should look like your china closet.
The china closet don't have any business being over here. It's in the den.
I know. You can rebuild this stuff, though.
Yeah, that's easier said than done.
Oh, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was hard to experience. You know, it was the house that I grew up in, and it's just rough to go back to that neighborhood and to see nothing. I mean, no life or anything like that. And then to see everything that was in my mom's house, all of her memorabilia and everything just totally destroyed.
And by the way, your mom, you know, she's got a son who's doing quite well. I'm guessing that she's not even the worst off.
Well, that's the sad part about the story. I mean, you know, with everything that my mom has lost, I mean, everything. I mean, we were talking about a wedding, and I was talking about who was in the wedding party. And we both got up to go get the pictures, and we realized they don't exist anymore. You know, so when things like that happen, it really breaks your heart. But having said that, my mom is still one of the very lucky ones. I do have the means to take care of her, and she's living in another home right now uptown, and she's comfortable. But, I mean, I think about a lot of people who really need the government's assistance, and I wonder what's going on with them and how they're faring and how they're doing. I mean, and the thing that's rough about it is that it didn't have to happen. I think that's the thing that angers most of us.
Well, you know, there are people in the film who, they have theories about how the levees, you know, were blown up. Are you saying that?
Not really, no. I mean, for me, it's more of a thing of neglect. You know, I mean, there are people who have been on what we have in New Orleans. It's called the Levee Board, and their sole job is to maintain those levees along with the Army Corps of Engineers. And, you know, none of those folks have done their job, obviously. You know, we constantly talk about a level 4, level 3 hurricane, you know, once it hit land. But what broke the initial levee is a level 1 tidal surge. This is such an outrageous situation. I mean, when you look at it, the second day after the hurricane hit, there were people all over every news media format known to man screaming for somebody to get down there and help those people. And, you know, for the government not to get down there till Friday is just totally irresponsible and disrespectful. I mean, that's the most hurtful thing about it of all. It's just disrespectful. I mean, it just makes you feel like a second-class citizen. It makes you feel like you don't matter. It's hurtful because these people come in, they will kiss our behinds for our vote every 4 years. But when we need them just for basic things, they weren't there to help us.
So, Terrence Blanchard, how do you put this in music?
I didn't try to put a lot of the hurricane or my emotions about it into music because the music would have been too distracting. for me, the most important thing in this particular piece are the stories, the words, you know, the interviews. Those are the most important things, because when you look at this documentary, you're going to see people, everyday people from all walks of life, talking about their experiences throughout this particular period and time in our history. And that's the most compelling thing about the documentary to me, more than the music.
You're saying you didn't want to overwhelm that, but critics are saying that, you know, your music stands out almost as a single character, blistering, thundering, dizzy with grief, some of the words that are being used. You know, it seems as if there's a little something more there than even the anger that we've heard you express through music in other films.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's heartbreak. I mean, this is the place that I grew up. You know, working on this project, I couldn't even get a break, because once, you know, I took a break, I walked out into New Orleans. I was going to my mom's house to check on people in the neighborhood and see how they were doing. You know, so it's a hard thing to deal with. So maybe that's what came through in the music. Initially was just to really keep people in the moment, because these interviews are very compelling. I mean, and the thing that you hear throughout all of them in various forms is that, where was the government? That's what people are asking. Where was the government? It's a very simple question that we still really haven't got any clear-cut answers to.
Well, when we spoke a year ago, you talked about how it was music coming from those drowned neighborhoods that was the hope. What do you say now? Is there hope for music still coming from those drowned neighborhoods?
There's definitely hope in the city. I mean, you know, one of the things that I feel very honored and proud to see is that in my mom's neighborhood, you see a lot of FEMA trailers. And the thing about it is they've all struggled just to get the FEMA trailers. I mean, it's been a fight. But once they've gotten them, a lot of people have already cleaned out their homes and they're starting to renovate their homes. And they're doing this all on their own. They're not really getting much help from the government right now. You know, and then to me, that speaks volumes about their spirit and their desire to rebuild the city. You know, and along with that, you know, you have the musicians who are coming back and you know, in small numbers right now, but there are enough musicians around the city who are, you know, doing a great job, you know, and trying to rebuild their lives. We use some of those guys on the score.
A trumpeter, bandleader, composer Terrence Blanchard wrote, and as we just heard, performed with other New Orleans natives, the score for When the Levees Broke, a Requiem in Four Acts, Spike Lee's documentary about Hurricane Katrina. It premieres on HBO next week. For more on Terrence Blanchard, by the way, you can go to our website here-now.org. And we just wish you well, and thanks for checking in with us.
Thanks for giving me a chance to talk about this, and thanks for everything that you're doing in terms of the story.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Two former t-shirt vendors search for relevance in Iraq, and Chopin's Nocturnes according to